a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Good morning. This is Joe Kufka with the Governor's Office. We are ready to begin, and here is Governor Dennis Dugard.
Good morning, and thank you all for joining for this press conference on Thursday. I'd like to lead off before opening to questions of any kind by talking about our budget. Yesterday, the Bureau of Finance and Management put together the most recent revenue numbers that we received from last month's collections, and compared it to the projections of revenue that were created when we built the budget that I proposed in early December. And there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is that the recovery is proceeding at about the pace that was projected when the budget was built. As you might remember, we were in December, as presenting the budget, I reported that our revenue was better than we had expected when the legislature adjourned last year, that revenue for the current fiscal year was coming in ahead of projections. And so based upon that, we would have some additional dollars to spend on a one-time basis in fiscal year 13, the year we're in right now, and that based upon that increase, we had built a more optimistic revenue projection for fiscal year 14 than we may have built a year ago. And then I proposed a budget to spend most of those dollars. We had left $16 million of one-time dollars unspent in fiscal year 13 and $10 million of one-time money unspent in fiscal year 14 for the legislature to offer its ideas for use. And as I say, the good news is that the revenue is almost precisely what we were projecting it to be. We've got variable receipts month by month. Some months are big months, as you might expect. At the end of each quarter, we have more income than we have at the end of most months in between. In months that include the Christmas season expenditures, we have higher revenues in those months, and so each month is not compared to the last month, but compared to a similar year's month. And as of the end of January revenues, which will include the December contractors' excise tax and the December sales and use tax numbers, we are 0.1% below our projection. So essentially a rounding error. We're really against $769 million. We're about $708,000 short. So 0.1% against the actual receipts. So good news is that we're on track. Bad news is we won't have additional extra revenue that we didn't foresee when the budget was built last December. And so I've had conversations with some of the legislature just yesterday about my hope is that they will continue to have responsible discussions about the revenue that we do have to spend. And but to the extent we were all hoping that things might be rosier, they're on track, but not any rosier than that. With that, I open it for any questions anyone may have. Chet?
Does that mean the $26.5 million that you left unspent for this year and next year, is that still there?
It's there, yes. It is there. No more is there.
Have you had any conversations with members of the legislature indicating how you might want to spend that money?
No, I tried to stay out of that. I've told some of the legislative leaders that I'd like to be engaged later. But in the meantime, I know that invariably you'll have probably ideas for spending that exceed the dollars. And so I was I think a responsible process would be for the legislature to reduce the proposals down to a mix of their highest priorities, and then I'd like to participate with them in judging those that remain.
Governor, as always, when you're talking about the budget, there's a lot of talk about school funding. This is one of the fierce issues of debates. And stepping back a little bit from the specifics, I just a question of philosophy for you. Is it a priority for you to increase, in a real sense, after inflation, how much the teacher pay in South Dakota, or is that something that is not a priority for you?
Well, I think it's a worthwhile goal. Teacher salaries are, those decisions are made at the local level. In some cases, it's difficult to drive teacher salaries up when we have so many schools. And in fact, if you look at the per pupil spending in South Dakota, we're well above the bottom. We're closer to the middle of the pack in terms of how much money is spent per pupil nationwide. And I'm using National Education Association numbers, the teachers union numbers. If you look at their ranking of expenditures per pupil, South Dakota does quite well. But the difficulty is when we're such a rural state and we want to have our local schools, and I don't begrudge local school districts from wanting to protect and maintain their schools as a community institution, well, then you end up with teachers with 10 kids in a class or 8 kids in a class. And that's a local decision. If they want to do that, then that makes it difficult to raise teacher pay statewide. But is it a worthy goal? Certainly. Raising teacher pay is a worthy goal. All that being said, I think we always must return to why we educate our children. It's to promote student achievement. It's not to compensate those who deliver it. So our goal should not be we want to achieve things that would presumably lead to the end, but really we always need to focus on the end, and that is student achievement. What ways can we improve student achievement? And improving teacher pay may be one way of doing that. It's not necessarily leading to that. Yes.
Victoria Wicks with Public Radio.
Yes, Victoria.
I read a news article from AP yesterday that the Lower Brule Tribe is gearing up to build a casino and event center, I believe, at Chamberlain. And it's kind of at the intersection of I-90 and the Missouri River. And I followed the state's 16-year battle to keep that piece of land out of trust, but I believe they lost that battle about 5 years ago. Are you planning to work with the tribe to make that happen? And do you see that it offers potential for South Dakota economic development, even though it's tribal land and not necessarily directly paying state taxes?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure South Dakotans want additional off-reservation gaming. I know the Constitution limits it right now to the Deadwood area. However, I'm also aware that tribes may present a proposal for off-reservation trust land located gaming to their communities, and then subsequently to the Secretary of the Interior, and then following these other steps, at the end, they present all the material that was gathered during those other steps to the governor for the governor's decision. And I have read myself the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act regulation that lays out that process. in that process, in short, requires the tribe to first have trust land, which they do, and then secondly, to engage any other tribe or government within 25 miles of the proposed location. So the tribe, as I understand it, is starting to engage the Crow Creek tribe, which is within 25 miles, the city of Ocoma, the city of Chamberlain, other cities within that 25-mile radius, the county governments within that 25-mile radius, to talk about the positives and the negatives. And then after those hearings and information exchange, then the tribe puts together an application with much of this information and submits it to the Secretary of the Interior, who, as I understand, in turn sends out letters to these same entities to collect more directly information from them and their attitudes about it. And then the Secretary makes a decision and then sends that entire file to me as governor. And it's only at that point that I believe that the regulation would have me make a decision. And I don't think it's appropriate for me to comment beyond it at this point until I have reached that point and have reviewed that file. Yes.
The decision you make, is that appealable?
No.
Governor, your decision, would that be to approve or amend a compact with the tribe? Would that be how your decision would be made?
I'm not sure that answer that, Chad. I'm not sure whether that would require an amendment to the gaming compact or whether this is outside of that. I just know that that my point in the process isn't here yet, and it's not ripe for me to opine.
Do we have any questions from folks on the line? And if you'd like to ask a question, press #6 to unmute. Immediately press *6 to remute your phone.
Governor Tony Mangan at KCCR.
Yes, Tony.
Still some talk among some legislators about wanting to do something about economic development in this session. Have you had any conversations with legislators about some sort of economic development legislation? And would you support anything like that?
I have had conversations with several legislators who've offered ideas. I've also looked at least one of the bills about it. I know it's early, and I don't want to say or hope for too much, but from what I've heard, I think both Republicans and Democrats, leadership and non-leaders, are engaged in conversation, and they've invited several staff members from my office to participate, and they participated in at least one large group discussion about it with both parties present and a couple of folks from my office as well. And I'm hopeful that those discussions will continue, that another such gathering will be held, and at some point we'll find something that is agreeable to all of us, and I think that would be good. I think that would be helpful to South Dakota as we try to build economic development, create jobs, better-paying jobs, and opportunities for our children and grandchildren.
Is there anything in particular you're looking at this point, Governor?
There's really a pretty broad spectrum of ideas that different legislators have, and we're open to looking at that spectrum. And so I don't have anything that I feel is inappropriately included in that discussion. I think the main thing is to listen and seek first to understand before being understood.
Governor, one of the highest profile bills this session has been the School Sentinels bill. And I know you've been asked about that in previous weeks, and that you've been having meetings with law enforcement and educators, which you said was going to be important for you as you make up your decision. It's the first part of my question is, so what are you hearing from these stakeholders in the state? And the second, how is this affecting your thoughts on this issue that is the topic of a lot of conversation?
Well, my most recent meeting was with the Sheriff's Association. I think it was last Friday, if I remember right. The weeks kind of blend together here. What I heard from them is they were concerned that the most recent iteration of the bill asks for their approval before a school district would be permitted to designate a sentinel who would then go be trained. And they were concerned about any prospective liability that might come their way as a consequence. And they were planning to introduce, as I understood it, an amendment when that bill is next up in the Senate. And I don't think it's heard in Senate committee yet. I think when it's heard in Senate committee, they want to introduce an amendment to clarify that they would not be liable if they make an approval that is reasonable. Or I'm not sure how they'll word it.
And then just the second part of the question, from what you heard from them and from educators and law enforcement in general, are you getting any sort of consistent picture of how these stakeholders are viewing it, and is this affecting your thoughts on this bill?
I think there's a tremendous variety of opinions. I've heard from some school board members who would like to have the local control to make that decision if they felt that the safeguards were adequate. I hear from people who insist on training and they're unaware that the current iteration of the bill contains a training requirement. There's a pretty broad spectrum of reactions. Some are knowledgeable reactions. Some, by their reaction, you can see they're not aware of the details of the bill. And that's understandable. It keeps changing. So I think it's important that these amendments, as they've been made to the bill, I think have improved the bill. And so I want to see, again, how the final version looks if it gets to my desk before I make a judgment about whether or not it's a good bill or not.
And one final follow-up on along that line. This has come up in past years as various high-profile legislator-sponsored initiatives. If you could talk a little more about your decision on when you wait until a bill comes to your desk for making a decision versus taking a look at it earlier and weighing it earlier in the legislative process where you could maybe get legislators to kill or change the things you don't like rather than having to take it to your desk and do a signature or veto.
Yeah, it's a hard judgment to make, though there will be some legislative proposals that I object to more from an underlying conceptual approach than from a disagreement with the particular language. I know certainly language matters a lot, and one word can make all the difference in a bill. On the other hand, if I believe that the concept that the sponsor is trying to promote is something I object to, then I think it's fair that the sponsor should know I object to it. I think most people who express opposition to the school sentinel bill do not object, or at least I have not heard anyone object, to a law enforcement officer providing that security in school settings as they do today in many places. They did at my children's school. And yet they are people. They are individuals. Just as these school sentinels would be individuals, the question is, would the training, would the ability, the maturity, the emotional stability of the school sentinel be as good as that of a law enforcement officer? And if so, then I'm hard-pressed to distinguish why one is is acceptable and supportable and one is not. So I think, but in any legislation, it's hard to know whether to weigh in earlier or wait till you see the specific language. I suppose it's always best to wait. On the other hand, if I know at the outset that I feel very strongly about something, to be fair to the sponsor, I should make that known to them. Yes, I think I don't object to the underlying concept so long as there's adequate safeguards.
Let's go back to our phones. Do we have any questions from our callers on the line? Any other questions in the room?
Hey, Nguyen, Aberdeen American News.
Yes.
I guess what are your thoughts on Medicaid expansion this session and whether or not you would consider a trigger like in Arizona or other states?
Yes, that's a good question. On the issue of Medicaid, I'm still open to the concept. My initial attitude as I presented the budget was founded in part upon my concern that the federal government will not keep up its end of the bargain. And, of course, some states have offered a trigger as a means for safeguarding. And the trigger is that if the federal government does not maintain its end of the bargain, that the trigger would then cause those who are made eligible by the expansion to suddenly become ineligible. While in concept that seems reasonable, in application it certainly is difficult to see being a realistic possibility. I believe when you add 40,000 people to the Medicaid rolls and then put a trigger in place, I wonder if there would be the political courage to allow that trigger to take place and remove those people from the rolls after they'd become dependent upon it. I also think it's worth noting that there is still a fairly high degree of misunderstanding of how the Affordable Care Act is going to relieve some of those who are without insurance from the burdens they bear regardless of whether we expand. An example of this, it was in the Rapid City Journal on Monday. Their front page story, their headline story, talked about Medicaid expansion. And there was a picture of a young woman with a beautiful little boy, and the story talked about her struggling to pay for insurance for herself and her son, and they could not afford to cover her husband. It's a three-person family, husband, wife, little boy. They were insuring her and her son, $700 a month, and that was tough for them. And the story implied that she had hope when she heard about the potential for expansion, and those hopes were dashed when proposal was not to expand. Well, in fact, to those knowledgeable, if you read the story, you know one fact is she is paying for insurance for her son today. That tells me that she and her husband have income over 200% of the poverty level, because otherwise their son, Odin, would be covered automatically today under our current laws. So if she's paying for him today, their income's over 200%. Well, if you have income at that level, a Medicaid expansion does not help you. But there's more news. The more news that most people are missing is that a substantial fraction, 22,000 of the 48,000, will be covered by significant premium subsidies in 2014, regardless of Medicaid expansion or no expansion. They will be eligible. In her case, it'll be less than this, or she'll have to pay more. She might have to pay 5% of her income. Some people down at the level of what we're talking about, 100 to 138% of poverty, they'll pay as little as 2% of their income, and they'll get coverage. And the federal government, through tax subsidies, will pay the rest. So a large fraction of the Medicaid expansion population are going to be eligible for these subsidies and pay a much more modest amount of their income than they would need to pay today. So the world is going to change significantly in 2014. For many of these people that present a compelling story and a human face that we want to help. And I think it's worthwhile for us to pause and allow some of those things to happen and then evaluate later whether we can afford to do it and whether the federal government really demonstrates that they've got the discipline to afford it now and in the future. Because right now, I've seen no indication that the federal government has any discipline whatsoever in their own budgeting. It'll be interesting to see what happens at the end of this month when the sequester would otherwise come into effect and what Congress does between now and then.
So you, Governor, your concerns about the Medicaid expansion have focused primarily, although not exclusively, on the possibility that they could not follow through on their promises and South Dakota would be left with either canceling it or paying the bill. I was trying to get a sense of how significant that objection is to you versus other objections. If you were confident that money would follow through, would Medicaid expansion be something you could get behind? Or do you have other objections that are significant enough that you would balk at expanding Medicaid even if you were confident about the money?
Well, I continue to hope that Congress will allow us to expand to cover those folks who are not eligible for subsidy and allow those that can get and will get a subsidy beginning 2014 to contribute at least a small part toward their own support. In fact, it was very interesting. The very story I just referenced, I'll quote from the story, she doesn't want free health care. She wants something like a sliding scale where the government will pay part, or now I'm paraphrasing, where she'll pay part based on her income. That's just what she'll get in 2014. Doesn't know it, apparently doesn't know it. And neither did the reporter know it, because they portrayed the absence of a Medicaid expansion as dashing her hopes for relief of the financial burden she's bearing to ensure herself and her son. So I think it's worthwhile that we wait, because a lot of this is still working out, and it's a big change in our world that's happening. The other thing is, by 2020, we'll be paying $36 million, even if the federal government does keep its share, under current assumptions. That's a lot of money, and that's $36 million that's not available for other worthy uses. And there's quite a bit of competition in this state for money for education, money to pay the providers we're already paying for Medicaid, and the rates that we're paying them for the services. So, again, I think it's still worth a continued conversation. It's not a now or never decision. If we don't expand today, we can still expand tomorrow.
If you were satisfied that confident the federal government wouldn't back down, would that be enough for you to support expansion?
It would be enough for me to continue the conversation. It's not the only concern I have, nor should it be the only concern any other policymaker has. There's lots of things that come into play. Can we afford it, even at that level? And to what extent are our projections proving accurate or inaccurate?
Let's go back to the phones once again. Is there anyone who has a question for the governor? #6 to unmute, and then *6 to immediately remute your phone. Any other questions in the room? If not, we'll close this. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.